Carriage 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hey everyone, welcome and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Sitting in front of me is my loyal sidekick of 2 episodes now, Gabe Haggard.
I've been a part of this for so long, the whole 2 weeks. It really means a lot.
Thank you.
And we have a special guest. I'm pleased to announce L.A. transplant, one of many, Jeff Ashkin, local filmmaker.
Thank you. Yes, L.A. native after 8 years.
We're going to count you as an L.A. native as of now.
Thank you.
You're officially on a podcast. I think that is the, you know,
that's the
sort of the benchmark. Once you get on a podcast, you know.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. On today's episode, we'll talk about Sight and Sound's choice for the greatest film of all time, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. As you may have heard, in 2012, it knocked Citizen Kane from its long-held throne. Are we ready to crown this the new king? Stay tuned. We'll follow that with a discussion about whether we as film snobs have an obligation to see movies that we might not enjoy. Can a movie be worth watching if it's not pleasant to do so? And we're going to finish off with a brief rundown of the projects we're currently working on.
This is a very interesting situation.
Okay, so today we've got a number of fun topics. First things first, we're going to talk about a little film called Vertigo. And it's made in 1958, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Gabe, how about you give us a little synopsis?
All right, so the film takes place in San Francisco, and it's about a retired detective who is sort of forced into retirement because of an accident by which he gets the disease that gives you vertigo. I don't remember what the disease is, but it's not as cool a word as vertigo, so I think that may be why they went with vertigo as the title.
Exactly.
And then he has a friend that comes along and asks him to tail his wife because he suspects that his wife is possessed by one of her ancestors. And sort of much fun is had by all, you know. I mean, I'm sure it came out in 1958, so I'm sure no one is that worried about spoilers. But still, I like to, you know, if someone hasn't seen it, I don't want to spoil it for them.
You know what? Everything is new to somebody, so let's. I do think that that should be our policy here.
Okay, and through the course of this podcast, I will go on to completely contradict that statement.
Absolutely,
because I will be spoiling it, and mostly I was just getting tired of trying to, you know, give a synopsis right off the top of my head.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and just issue a spoiler warning right off the bat. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Jump to the next segment. Judy and Madeline are the same person. Oh my god. Oh my god.
I get some hate mail for that.
Ugh.
I don't know.
Okay. So, by the way, the disease is acrophobia. Just FYI.
All right. Okay, Pauline. But I think that's cheating a little bit. Okay?
I did open a textbook.
There's a laptop right in front of me. I could Google it and figure out all this information. But I think part of the charm of this podcast is that we're here together, you know, discussing and utilizing what has brought us as individuals to this point in our lives.
Absolutely.
And so we're not interested in what the textbooks might say at this point.
Okay.
We're just more interested in what and how we have developed to this point in
Absolutely.
Our lives.
Absolutely. Okay, so what did you guys think of the film? Jeff, I know you are fond of this movie.
Yes, I am.
What about it do you love?
Well, it's the universal desire for people to make something into what they want. Mm-hmm. And we have that in the beginning of the film where you have Jimmy Stewart's character who falls in love with this woman who's not what he thinks she is, obviously. And it's funny because Alistair, I think the guy who hired him, he's made her over into his wife, I mean, who, and she's not obviously his wife, and he's made over to what he wants. And then later in the film, Jimmy Stewart makes over Judy into Madeline, and it's like, oh, okay. So it's basically making a comment that what we do is we try to make people over into what we want. And I think that's what a universal theme that I feel holds up really well, despite you know, being from 1958. It showed it in a way that was entertaining, and I really appreciated the effect of it. And of course, the music is incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the score is just amazing. Bernard Herrmann. I've read that he actually based it on the Tristan and Isolde theme, and you can kind of hear it too. But I mean, it's just a magical score, and it completely underlines everything you feel about that film. And
so. Yeah, and I think they really rely on the score
right
throughout so much of it. It's sort of in many parts a slow paced film, but you don't get bored. You're not yet taken out of it. And I'm saying even through the lens of like 2013, when so much filmmaking has become so frenetic and so like boom 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 happening so quickly, you can still sit down and enjoy a movie like Vertigo. And I think that's driven so much by the score.
So. Vertigo is an adaptation of a French book, and they wanted Hitchcock to adapt it into a movie. But in the book, the reveal that Judy and Madeline are the same is at the end. But Hitchcock changed that because he went for suspense over surprise. Do you guys think, was the suspense effective? Do you think it would have worked better had it come at the end?
I don't know. In a lot of ways, I feel like when I'm watching it, it's an incredible film and I love it, but I almost feel like even the first time you watch it, because of that reveal being where it is, you feel like you're watching a great film for the second or third time. And so I don't know, I feel like since it took away that surprise, what do you say, as opposed to suspense, like it kind of took that away, I wonder what kind of a film it might have been if we had discovered more along with Scotty what was happening. Even if it, the movie seems to be telling the story of how he gets over vertigo. And so I wonder, is that supposed to be all in his look when he looks like down the bell tower and sees her dead? Like, was that, is that it?
He's cured. Well, it's a miracle.
Yeah, it's like the ultimate irony. He has finally cured his vertigo, but he's lost the woman of his life twice now. You know what I mean? Now he's lost her the first time with Madeline. Now he's lost her second time with Judy. There is, I'm sure, I have to mention this because I think it was so interesting that they made this coda where he goes back to his apartment and he runs into Midge, his friend, who's his former fiance, I think, in the story, and they have a radio playing in the background that said, Alistair was apprehended at the airport. And they talk about basically the guy who basically gets away with murder being arrested. So,
right,
they
had to like cut that in to make
he's
sure.
He's arrested. You know what I mean?
It's all good.
And that was basically cut in because they wanted to make sure, back in the 50s, it was very rare for a film. I can't think of any other examples on top of my head where the bad guys get away with something. And this is one of the few films I had seen where that whole thing is not as interesting or important or integral to the story. It's basically his relationship with Judy / Madeline. Sorry, and it's just interesting though because it ends like I said with that one iconic shot, and that's it. That's the end of the movie. Hitchcock, being Hitchcock, got away with that. I thought that's fascinating.
Yeah,
and that's interesting. Can you say more about this theme? The theme sort of love is Hitchcock trying to make a commentary? Is it sort of a tragedy in the sense that it's like, look, you can't make over or you can't force your love to be what you want, and it's sort of more important to accept. Like with Judy, when she is pleading with him, and then at a certain point, we know that she, and I feel like we know that Judy really does love him. And she's pleading with him, like, please just love me.
Yeah.
And Scotty is saying, no. And with, making her do all these things, whereas, I don't know, this seems like that could be a commentary on the fact, like, look, just love, love real people. You can't necessarily impose your own will on love.
But given what we know about Hitchcock and his relation to women and particularly blonde actresses, do you feel like that's the message that Hitch would want to project onto this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not terribly confident.
I'm sorry,
if that's your reading, that's a perfectly legitimate interpretation.
What's the question exactly, if I'm making sure?
So Hitchcock has this particular relationship with his actors,
yes.
Especially women, the icy blonde that we all have come to know and love. But the idea that you can't make over, or it is unhealthy to try and make over a woman in whatever image you want. Is that something that Hitch, that seems like counterintuitive to what we know about Hitchcock?
That's a good question. For Vertigo, I feel it's his most personal film, we mentioned, and I don't feel like he followed up with it afterward. I think his comment in Vertigo is that to make someone over in what you want is wrong. Yeah, I think if there is a message to be had, I think that's what it is. You can lose that love by trying to make it over.
So you're saying he's a hypocrite.
Well, it's funny you said it, because I had a long conversation with a friend of mine. He doesn't like Vertigo at all. His quote basically, it's a film by a creep for creeps.
I feel like the artist himself doesn't necessarily need to be a virtuous man to describe and to create works of art, or making a true, you know, ethical or moral point. So the fact that we now hear a lot of stories about, you know, how difficult or, you know, how horrible it was to work with Hitchcock, and, you know, his sort of skewed view and the horrible things that he would do to his actresses, it doesn't, you know, necessitate that be reflected in all of his art.
But I think Vertigo, though, he did reflect maybe the way he did act, making people, I mean, as a director, you make people over into what you want. That's what a director does. You know what I'm saying? So technically, Jimmy Stewart is, in fact, take this leap with me, a director in the sense that he's making over this actress to be what he wants.
Right,
so,
exactly.
So I can see definitely people thinking this must be a personal film for Hitchcock, because that's what he does. That's his career.
Right. You know? So I was going to ask you guys, to what extent is this Jimmy Stewart character like Hitchcock's proxy, or his stand-in? Is Kim Novak's transformation from Judy to Madeline a commentary about being a director? Is that explicit?
I don't feel that it's explicit mm-hmm. in the film, because the moment when it becomes sort of overtly obvious what Scotty is trying to do, it's also shown to be, I think, at the very least, uncomfortable and then ending ultimately very despicably. So I don't think it's an overt theme of the film that you know, hey, this is me, you know, and this is what I do to women. I don't feel it's that as much, because you know, once that becomes clear at all, like as soon as Jimmy Stewart starts doing that to her, you're kind of like, you start, you know, getting a little uncomfortable.
What does the Midge character mean to you guys? What do you think she's doing in there?
If I recall correctly, I don't think she was in the book. She is, I guess, I'll use a term, spinster, as mm-hmm. I'd say, like, or as, from what, you know, what I can tell, like, she's basically the woman that he would have ended up with had he not fallen in love with Madeline. She's basically Miss Exposition, I feel like, that okay. character. There's only one scene, I believe, where there's some drama with her, and that's when he comes home and he sees that she's painted herself into the portrait, and he's like, what is this, some kind of joke, you know, and then he leaves and she's upset. And it's nice that Hitchcock, and I will give credit to the writers, of course, Samuel Taylor and Alec Coppel, that scene gives you a little insight in that obviously she still has feelings for him, she still loves him, and he's not accepting of her. So it's like the insight into the general conceit of the film, which is he's trying to make people over into what he wants, and now she's saying, you know, I still love you, and he will not accept her for who she is, and, you know, goes out to go back to that fantasy, you know.
Mm-hmm. So as far as her just being there for exposition, I mean, why did they choose to make her a woman? You know, they could have had a buddy, but I think it's, you know, because we need something to contrast with this Kim Novak character. So how is Midge different than the Kim Novak character?
Well, she wears glasses.
There's that.
Yeah. that's one. We'll put it this way, she's not mysterious. I mean, we kind of know who she's all about. I mean, we get that scene in the very beginning where you're just kind of like, okay, I know this type. You know what I mean? I know this woman. She seems nice, and she's just not this, you know, mystery that he has to solve. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's, like I said, he has to go off that fantasy and discover about Madeline. So I feel like she's basically the safe one. You know what I mean? That the one that you never go for.
You know who she kind of reminds me of? Have you seen a Philadelphia Story?
Yeah, with Katharine Hepburn. Yeah.
In that movie, Jimmy Stewart falls for Katharine Hepburn. Mm. But as all that's happening, he's sort of involved with this other photographer woman. Yeah. It's sort of like an interesting play on that. It's sort of a callback for me. But speaking of Jimmy Stewart, you don't cast Jimmy Stewart without knowing exactly how to use Jimmy Stewart. To what extent do you think his persona is used effectively in this movie?
Jimmy Stewart, obviously, at this time, he had obviously was a big name. I think that his brand, in terms of his what people go to see him, is that he's plays a very, innocent, but a very straightforward guy. Mm-hmm. Like I would say, like to compare him to someone now would be like Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that sense of who he is really guides you through the film, and you're on his side.
Okay, so yeah. You think it was so basically the audience needs a proxy, like he's the good old all-American,
yeah.
Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
We know this guy. But do you think – I think it was like a stroke of genius to have him play against type. And he's done this before, like what was that? Was it The Naked Spur? Is that right?
I don't know.
I think Anthony Mann. So he's played bad guys in the past. But I think he's the bad guy in this, you know. Obviously, it's a really complex movie. Mm. But I certainly don't think he's the good guy. So, but Gabe, what do you think?
Well, what's always frustrated me, I mean, even from the very first time I saw this film as like, you know, a 10-year-old or 8-year-old, it was that it's two different movies. It feels like that to me, mm-hmm. that it's one film with Madeline and then it's another film with Judy. And I think that maybe plays into a little bit of what you're saying. For the majority of the film, or I would say through the first film, or the first act, or the, you know, Vertigo Part 1, you are sympathetic towards him. We don't have any reason, aside from, I think, maybe feeling like maybe he's not treating Midge the way he should be, you are on his team. You are rooting for him. And so things are happening to him. But then in the second film, in the second act, part two, he starts turning, and then you're not rooting for him. What Jimmy Stewart kind of undergoes is, you know, a fate worse than death, you know, to have to continue on with your loved one or two or three or four, however many people he loved. Like, is it Madeline he's in love with? Is it Judy he's in love with? Is it Carlotta he's in love with? And so I think that really changes. It is like a really complex movie. And I feel like he didn't quite make it a perfect film because of that feeling a little bit of a disjointedness. Mm-hmm. That the first half or first act, you know, and the second act or, you know, part one and part two don't quite mesh in my mind completely.
I do want to talk about that, our overall feelings about the film, because I do share some of your thoughts about the way the movie's structured. But before we get into that, I just want to talk quickly about, do you guys relate to Scotty? Gabe?
Well, okay. I feel like I can always relate to Jimmy Stewart in the sense that, I mean, he might not be like a Bogart, you know, but he's a pretty cool dude, you know.
Okay.
And so you feel like on that level, you feel like you can relate, you know, an old like cool like detective, blah blah blah, you know. Then again, I don't want to keep going back to it, but like in the first part, you're kind of rooting for him. You know, he's kind of doing a solid for his friend, and then he falls in love with this mysterious woman. I'm not a big fan of the fact that, you know, he falls in love and starts making out with his friend's wife. Like, that does not rock.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, like, I can and I can't. Like, I see why. Again, this is going back to the discussion of why Jimmy Stewart was cast in the beginning, or, you know, because, yeah, he's, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, is it possible we think he's a good guy in the first act, and that because we have this expectation of Jimmy Stewart, but as you mentioned, like, he's making out with his friend's wife, you know, he's pretty callously ignoring Midge. He has to know that she's in love with him, you know, but I'm just going to plop down on your couch because I'm Jimmy Stewart. And
hey, she called it off.
That's it.
She called it off.
That's true. Mm.
His hands are tied at this point.
Yeah.
You know?
What could he do?
Just make me another cocktail, Midge, okay?
It was the 50s. So
it was the 50s.
You know.
Not to mention, okay, this is the really, this is creepy. When he pulls Kim Novak out of the bay, he takes her back to his apartment, not to a hospital, to his apartment where he presumably undresses her and leaves her there for several hours to sleep. Hopefully she wakes up. Who knows? So I think maybe it's not as disjointed as we might think. You know, like maybe he's not really a good guy, you know?
That's true. That's definitely a possibility. And I guess the way I was reading that was that I don't know how – I felt like it had been pretty explicit that his friend did not want the authorities involved at this point. Hmm. Like, we just need to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't want to take her to the hospital because that would have immediately opened up a can of worms that why did she – you know, why did she throw herself off into the bay, you know, all that kind of stuff. Now, there was certainly – like, it may have been, like, mishandled. And again, that may be just my own naive reading into it. That
he's Jimmy Stewart. He would never undress a girl unless he absolutely had to.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly the point.
Yeah.
That, you know, hypothermia, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know, you get their clothes off no matter what it is.
Right.
You know, you get their clothes off and get them in a warm bed. And so I appreciated and enjoyed, like, obviously that creates some sexual tension. But I was still thinking, oh, well, but that's what you got to do what you got to do.
Okay. Jeff, do you relate to Jimmy Stewart?
Well,
to
I
Scotty?
Mean, well, I think we've all been in love before. Mm. And we've all chased some mystery woman, mm-hmm. haven't we? No. I really feel that, as going about what you said earlier, I mean, there are things he does that we kind of like, oh man, he's, you know, kissing his friend's wife, you know, and I feel that, you know, the casting of Jimmy Stewart works to a point. And as a man myself, there are things that he does that I'd be like, yeah, I could see myself doing that, doing a, you know, a favor for a friend. And then there's some things that I would, you know, not do, you know, like make over some strange woman into another strange woman. You know what I mean? Okay. It's funny. I was not here for your Citizen Kane discussion. Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to mention Citizen Kane now. One of the problems I've had.
There's nothing more to say about Citizen Kane. It was exhausting.
Except this one point here. Except this one point. No, basically, I'm going to relate it to Federico. Watch this. Okay. Here we go. Basically, with Citizen Kane, I've had discussion with people, a lot of people who don't have the same affection for it that I do. And I realize one of the main reasons why I feel people don't connect to Citizen Kane as much. It's not one of those movies that I feel like is as loved as it should be. You know, not to go on a rant about Citizen Kane. Like I said, I know you guys all talked about it. But the thing about Citizen Kane is I don't feel that there is as many sympathetic characters in that film. People don't relate as much to it. I feel like with Vertigo, there's more empathy to be had, more sympathy to be had with those characters. And I feel like that's one of the reasons why I feel Vertigo has replaced it. Not to say that I agree with their decision.
All right, hang on.
Okay.
We're getting ahead of ourselves
all right.
here.
Well, I was going to say that. They're replacing the Sight and Sound poll. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay, hang on. Before we get to the Sight and Sound poll, I just want to address the elephant in the room. What is up with Kim Novak's eyebrows?
Oh, disgust. Man. That's a note I made, too.
Okay.
You might. All right, whatever. We can talk about the greatest film of all time later.
Right.
This is a more important issue.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
This was a bold, bold choice. I'm assuming it was a choice.
I don't know. They're a train wreck.
I got to be honest with you. I've never noticed.
I'm just saying, go back. Watch all 2 hours and 10 minutes of it again. And tell me what you think about her eyebrows.
All right, I'll have to make a commentary.
They're like tar. They're like made from tar or something.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but there's definitely something wrong.
See, these are the subtleties.
Yeah,
I will say
we pick up.
Well,
you know, this is why you come to FlixWise.
Okay, the reason why she probably didn't have them ready in time was because she was supposed to be the lead role. It was supposed to be Vera Miles, wasn't it? Vera Miles.
I think it was.
Then she got pregnant, and then they couldn't use her, but then. You know, she got me available again, but they already chose Kim. So she probably was like, you know what?
So,
if I had known I was going to be in it, I would have, you know.
No, okay. So you're saying, like on. No. It's not just that they were
they
not
were painted.
Shapely.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's the thing. So you're saying on her off season she
hey.
It's like, I didn't know I had a gig. I wouldn't have shaved my eyebrows.
You know, I don't know what her reasons were for
that's true.
Her choice
you don't
in the
judge.
Film.
You don't want to judge.
I have to say, I did not notice my first, second, or third viewing of this film. but now this is
now
all I'm going to notice now.
That is it.
No more than that. Okay.
Okay.
This is just one of the reasons why I think Citizen Kane should still be number one.
Absolutely.
I also agree on that
transition. Okay. So in 2012, Vertigo supplanted Citizen Kane as the number one movie. The entire Sight and Sound list of the top movies, the greatest movies ever made. Obviously, we're on number two. So we can't really say whether Vertigo deserves its place as King of the Hill. But we have seen Citizen Kane. So do you guys think it's worthy of its title?
No.
No.
Are we saying Vertigo being the one film of all time
yes.
versus Citizen Kane or just in general? I mean,
either way. I mean, obviously we can't – I haven't seen every movie on the list. For all I know, what's a movie I haven't seen on the list?
There are a lot of French ones.
There are a lot of
French
ones. Yeah, Woman is a Woman. I've never seen that, you know.
I haven't seen that.
So maybe that's the greatest movie ever made. But as far as movies, like, do you think it's better than Citizen Kane? Why do you think they decided to mix it up after 50 years?
I'm not sure myself. First of all, it's hard to say what's really the best film of all time. I mean, it's like saying what's the best painting of all time,
right.
What's the best book of all time.
Absolutely.
I mean, but I will say Citizen Kane is one of the most important films of all time, one of the most interesting films of all time, one of the most creative. And because of all those things, I would argue, yes, you can probably say it's the best film. And I would definitely say it's one of the best films of all time, if not the best film. I would definitely rank it more highly than Vertigo, yes.
And I think, I agree as well, would rank it more highly than Vertigo. And I think we'd have to look to an external reason, aside from the two films, as to why the one supplanted the other in 2012.
Right.
Because, as you pointed out, Vertigo, some 50 or so years ago, not quite 60.
Not quite 60.
And Citizen Kane, another decade, several decades prior to that. And so I feel like it's kind of ridiculous that they would make a change like that up at the top now. Mm. We've had plenty of time to watch each movie several times. And we don't want to omit the fact that new things can be learned upon subsequent viewings. Mm. For example, the eyebrows. You had not noticed the eyebrows.
If I hadn't come today, never would have known that.
You are welcome.
Thank you.
But at the same time, I feel like if you want to make a list of the greatest films of all time, and you have two films that have been, you know, out of theaters for over 50 years, and then you go and change something like that, like, that doesn't ring true to me to say that, okay, now it's better. Well, it hasn't changed. Those two films have not changed.
Right.
What do you mean now it's better?
Right.
I feel like it's – I mean, this is maybe the same thing. Like, what does it mean to say this is the best film of all time? That's the best film of all time. That's all, like, pretty ridiculous. But I think at the very least you have to stay consistent that, you know, and you have to judge these films on their own merits. So it seems so obvious to me that they're looking to something else outside
right.
of these two films.
Do you
films.
Think they just got tired of Citizen Kane being number one? Is it that simple?
It's probably, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's like a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
Like, who are these Sights and Sounds characters? That they're like, we got to get more eyeballs on this list, you know? It's like Spielberg's probably not going to make another masterpiece. We got to shake this up somehow.
Yeah.
You know, we don't see the next crop of young directors like, you know, we're going to lose our jobs. We got to get, you know, and exactly, because why are we talking about it now? Because it makes us so furious,
right.
or myself, so furious that they would go and change it. Oh, it's different now?
Right.
After 50
years?
Well,
so you don't think the cultural tides have turned and, like, there's been some great change in the way we now see Vertigo? Like, it's, I mean, I do think that, you know, you can perceive a film differently through a different cultural lens. So it could be, I mean, these lists go every 10 years. So after 10 years, something about in 1992, between 1992 and 2012, right? So what happened? I mean, why has this film grown in such esteem? Go ahead, Jeff.
I'll fill this one here. No,
yeah.
it just goes back to what I was saying earlier. I feel that Citizen Kane doesn't have the same catharsis that Vertigo has. Mm. I put the word catharsis.
That's very nice. Yeah,
thank you.
Strong. Very bold.
Thank you. Well, it's just that regardless of how I feel about the main characters in Vertigo, the story that is told is so universal, I feel like, in terms of how you feel about love, how you feel about making people over what you want, and how you feel about, you know, making the strange into the familiar and vice versa or whatever. Citizen Kane is not as, I feel, effective as making you identify with Kane or his friend character played by Joseph Cotton. I can't think of the name right now.
Jed Leland.
I thought that was the thing. Okay, yeah. Or any of them. There's no character in that film that I would say, man, I see myself as that character or that character. And I feel like – sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it's interesting you say that the characters are more universal in Vertigo. I feel like the motivation for Citizen Kane or Charles Foster Kane, I feel like that motivation is far more universal than obviously I'm a woman, and I feel like Vertigo has a very distinct, you know, masculine perspective, or, you know, like heterosexual male perspective. But that desire to make over your beloved into whatever image you want, I'm not sure that I relate to that as strongly as the desire to be loved and maybe going about doing that in a selfish way. Mm. But I feel like Citizen Kane is maybe more austere. So maybe in that sense, it's harder to like really penetrate that character.
I would say almost, and this is it sounds, I don't mean it sounds in a negative way, but Citizen Kane is not as emotionally manipulative as Vertigo. Mm. I don't want to say that in the terms to make Vertigo sound like it's like in a negative way, but Citizen Kane presents itself as a film where you get a lot of different points of view, and you're not going to know who you're supposed to be associating with. And I think that's the reason why I feel that people kind of hold it at arm's length, and I think more people admire it than be like, oh, I love that film. Because I feel like the films that people really love, quote unquote, are the ones that they just associate with, and they just love those characters, they love those people, love that journey they take.
Yeah.
And Citizen Kane, you learn about a guy who was not that great of a guy, and you're fascinated by him, and he's a fascinating person, but it's not like somebody you're like, you know, you want to be or you want to spend too much time with.
Well, okay, so Gabe, do you like Vertigo?
Yes, I do. I enjoy watching the film a lot. It's, you know, like we've been discussing for all these reasons. Like, I would not sit here idly by and discuss it for this long if I did not enjoy it. But, yeah, I think it's a great film. With the caveat, like I mentioned, that I feel like, well, now I have seen it a lot of times, but, you know, I feel like I'm watching a great film for the second or third time.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I do enjoy it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of there with you, I think, in that it's not my favorite Hitchcock film. And I think
what is your favorite Hitchcock?
My favorite Hitchcock. Well, I have three.
Oh boy.
Are you ready?
It's a tie for...
All right. This is another
day.
Podcast.
All right. But for whatever reason, this film, I don't think it's as well plotted as Citizen Kane, and I don't think it's as well plotted as some of his other movies. Additionally, I don't think it has that Hitchcock sense of humor that a lot of movies do. This one is not funny. Like, this one, I appreciate that. It's like it's really sick, in a different way than some of his other ones. Like,
I'm glad that you mentioned the sick aspect, because before, when you mentioned identifying or not identifying with it, you mentioned that it comes at it from a very, you know, heterosexual male point of view and treatment of women. Let's be clear, a perverted,
right.
Like, you know, male perspective of how women should be treated.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not, this isn't like, like,
you know. Not all men.
No. And yeah. not all men, but not, I would say not real men.
Okay. So, I do want to talk about that. So,
I'm not saying like, yeah, like, I like it because I identify with him. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but
paint
I mean,
on those
I am,
eyebrows.
I am curious to what extent, you know, heterosexual men can relate to this, the experience of like the ethereal, you know, blonde, mysterious woman that you want to, like, you can project your feelings onto. And then ultimately, like, when they can't quite live up to it, you try and manipulate them into whatever image you want. Is that a universal desire for men. It could also be for women.
I mean, I feel like, you know, there are for, you know, real men, there can be, you know, you'll have ideals or you know, fantasies or, oh, my perfect woman, X, Y, or Z, you know. But any sort of contact with real life, in my experience, generally throws that out the window. Mm-hmm. And in terms of being a good man or being a real man, mm-hmm. you know. So, yeah, you might, you know, see a beautiful blonde and idealize what that girl might be like. But where I say where it turns sick is the moment that you find out that she dyes her hair blonde and then insist that she continue to dye her hair blonde or you'll never speak to her again.
Right.
That's when it becomes sick.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So is it universal to men? Well, it's universal to men to have specific certain desires or to have fantasies or ideals. And then this film is about a perversion of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not saying that universal to men, it's universally perverse.
Okay. You know?
So it's a perversion of the universal.
Okay. That's kind of my question. Like it's a perversion of something that is typical in human beings, basically.
Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So. It's interesting. I was just thinking about it. Like the whole making over a person, isn't that more associated with what women do to guys that they date? just a thought.
Gabe, you wanna get on your
nerves? But in this case, it's a man. So enough on that. So I think we're all in agreement. We like and appreciate this movie, but I don't think any of us think it's the greatest movie ever.
No,
made.
I just really don't. There are too many aspects about it that. You know, kind of give you pause for thought in a way in terms of whether or not it's true, unadulterated, top of the heap cinematic genius.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. The characters are so troubling, and like I think about why does Judy fall in love with Scotty? What is she doing with him? You know, like why is it a given?
I mean, you could make the claim that she has fallen in love with her perception of.
Maybe. Just see Jimmy Stewart in those bright blue eyes and just lose your head, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like the guy that she fell in love with was the guy that was romancing Madeline. So she's in love with that guy. And now she realized, man, this guy is really messed up. But I still, you know, I mean, so you could say that in her point of view, she hasn't been as perverse as he is, but she's fallen in love with an image of, you know, who she thinks he is.
Yeah.
You know?
And, yeah. And then at what point, I don't know at what point you would sit her down and like, you know, slap her around a little and be like, hey, no, stop loving this guy. At that point, then it's already like too late and there's bell towers and that. Yeah.
Okay. And on that note, let's move on to our next topic.
High anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear. My heart's afraid to fly. It's crashed before. But then you take my hand. My heart starts to soar once more.
Okay, so for the next topic, we're going to discuss movies that we feel obligated to see, even though we have no real desire to see them. Case in point. This year's Oscar race will likely be dominated by a movie called 12 Years a Slave. This movie, directed by Steve McQueen, come on now.
it's not the same one that you're thinking of.
Different Steve?
Yeah,
okay, gotcha.
The other one's dead.
I'm still not over it, sorry. This movie's received nothing but accolades, and yet I personally feel very little desire to see it. And I feel like the only reason that I would ever see it was out of guilt. I feel like I'm being coerced into seeing this movie. And I feel like by opting not to see it, I feel like I've committed like a sin against film snobbery. Like there's a completist in me that feels like I should really go and watch it. So Gabe, as my confessor, are you going to alleviate me of this guilt or are you going to enforce the idea that I'm a total fraud?
No, I feel like film is there to predominantly, or first and foremost, to entertain us. And so if you feel as though you would not be entertained in any way, shape, or form, I don't feel as though you should feel guilty about not wanting to see any certain film. And certainly there are many other things that film can do for you. It can enlighten, it can teach people something they don't know, it can, you know, do all these other things. However, first and foremost, I believe it is a medium of entertainment. And so if it ceases to be that for you, there's no call to force yourself to see something.
Okay. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I truly agree with Gabe on that point. But I will add to that that I was not interested in seeing the film, and I happened to see it. And I was very entertained by it. It is a very intense film. I will say that it's very well done. And it's nice for me. One of my favorite experiences is when you go into a film and you don't know what it's about. Obviously, you can kind of tell what it's about from the poster and the title. I mean, you're pretty clear on that, at least from, you know, the subject matter. But it's great when you go into a film not knowing what it's about and it surprises you. I feel that in our society... In our society, there is a certain...
Tell us about our society, Jeff.
It's like, society in general, no. There's films now, I feel, have become... certainly from the big studios, like event movies. You want, like, they want to go see the big event. It's in 3D. It's in the biggest screen possible. And I feel like that's more appealing to people who have to pay to see films. See, one of the things about myself is I really have to pay to see films. Now I sound really like...
You might not know this. You might know this, but it's kind of a big deal.
I really see... No, but the thing is, but because of that, oh, I can see all these films and I'm like, oh, it was great. That was great. But my point of view is, if I had to tell somebody, you have to get out of your house... Get in the car, brave the traffic, go pay $18 nowadays or whatever just to go see the film. Would I recommend this film? But having seen 12 Years a Slave, yes. But if you're not interested in the subject matter, if you're not interested, you may not enjoy it. I don't know. It's not a film that left me feeling great afterward. It's right. Like, oh, I mean, you got to see it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of more the point. Like, it's not so much that I'm not interested in the subject matter. It's that I am concerned that I'm going to feel worse after having seen it. Like, okay, so I'm going to contest your opinion that all movies have to be entertainment. I think movies function in a lot of ways. Some movies, for me personally, I have a visceral reaction to certain violent elements of film. Particularly rape is like a big trigger for me. So I feel hesitant to go in and watch movies that feature rape. And I'm wondering, can I give myself a pass in those circumstances, you know?
Well, and what I would say is there are certain a larger sense. There are certain things I feel that don't have any business being in films to begin with.
Okay.
Like you mentioned, you know, the gruesome violence or rape. I don't feel that there is any necessity to show that. And I would like to support my thesis being that films should be. I'm not saying that they are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying they should primarily be concerned with entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain things that are antithetical to entertainment. And I would say that they should not be in films or should not be in films in an overt manner.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the hypothesis being just because something happens doesn't mean we have to or we should watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody poops.
Yes.
It does not mean that we should watch it. And so when faced with that, like wondering whether or not you could or should see a film, I think that's a perfectly legitimate reason to feel personally that you do not want to see it. A big example for me would be the horrific violence of the film The Passion of the Christ. Mm-hmm. I saw it. I think it's, you know, in many ways a good film. But I have absolutely no problem with someone that says, I don't like the violence. I'm not going to see it. That's totally all right with me.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, one of those like, well, if you don't love the Passion of the Christ, you're not really Christian. Like, well, that's not, you know, that's not true. It's they are merely films.
Right.
And I passionately love filmmaking. So I don't mean that in the sense that they're not powerful, they're not valuable, they're not great.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, then I feel that, you know, you can put them in their place, as
right,
it were.
Right. Yeah. So do I have an obligation as someone who I consider myself to be somewhat, you know, a cinephile, let's say, borderline. This means that, like, there are a lot of really, really great, important movies that I'm just either not going to see, or I'm going to see and I'm really, really not going to like them, despite whatever cinematic value they may have.
Well, that's the thing, Pauline. You got to take the power back. You are in control. You are in the driver's seat here, okay? If you enjoy film and filmmaking, then enjoy it. But enjoy it on your own terms, in a way.
Okay.
Okay. These films are there, you know, for our pleasure, you know. And there are how many different ways are there to skin a cat? Many ways, and we don't need to see that graphically. I don't need to show you how I skin a cat, but I'm saying that you don't need to feel that just because you quote unquote missed out on one particular film, that in some way you are no longer a cinephile,
okay,
or you are no longer an appreciator or a lover, a true connoisseur of the medium of film, just because you have chosen not to see this one or that one.
Okay, yeah. I mean, and also, like, Steve McQueen in particular has this reputation for, like, sadism. He's almost, like, punishing the audience, at least in prior films. Like, Shame, it's like this really bleak look at, like, sex addiction, and it's just...
We have to talk about the style. I mean, and as you mentioned, you know, Steve McQueen has a very distinctive style. And I would say that Shame was a film that I saw and I appreciated. Would I want to see it again? No. But I appreciated the film in its, you know, context of what it was trying to say about sex addiction. 12 Years a Slave, also a very brutal film. Not a film that I would want to experience over and over again as well.
Okay.
But, like I said, still a great film.
Still glad you saw it?
Still glad I saw it, yeah.
Okay. But do you have any emotional triggers? To be clear, I've seen, there are a few films, like, I've watched them and then regretted them. Regretted having ever seen them. Like, okay, so I watched Ingmar Bergman's The Virgin Spring, where it's basically the story of a young girl who gets brutally raped and murdered in the woods, and her father comes upon her attackers, or they come upon him, and he murders them. And I know, I'm pretty sure this is on the Sight and Sound list, this movie. After having seen this movie, like, I had a stomach ache for days.
Well, I mean, I think in just a very straightforward sense, then, you know, I would say then don't watch them.
Okay.
Whether or not you may take issue with my assertion that film is about purely entertainment.
Right.
It's certainly, I think we could agree that it should not be, you know, vomit-inducing, perhaps? Or not.
There are some films, yes, that would that are specifically for that. I mean, we can go on a rant about.
But you know, it shouldn't be causing you physical harm.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe. Okay.
I think you could. I can definitely say you can be a film fan and say, okay, there's certain subject matters that I just have trouble dealing with, and that's understandable. I mean, I've heard that a lot from a lot of people. Off the top of my head, I can't think of a subject matter that I would say, like, oh, I can't watch that. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. There's some directors that I may be like, I don't know if I'll watch that person's work.
Who?
Or just how many Malick films can you work your way through?
I'm not going to name names.
Why not? Hang on now.
No, but I can't think of anything that I would say like, oh, you know, I would not want to, you know, watch that subject matter. If it's well made, it's well made. And if the true test of it, oh, I really enjoyed it, is would I want to see it again? Or would I not want to see it again because it you know, touched me so deeply that I don't know if I want to experience it again.
Yeah. I can probably get away with never seeing The Virgin Spring. But, like, for a movie like 12 Years a Slave, where it has this pretense of importance, you know, this is a part of the American experience. I mean, and that's where I sort of disagree with your statement that movies are purely entertainment. In this case, it feels like it's almost about explaining our history. You know, it's a part of us. Granted, we weren't around, but I think in that case, like, do we have more of an obligation to go and watch them?
No, I would say that we don't have an obligation to watch it. You know, there may be different films that you can get more or less out of, aside from a purely entertainment or education or things of that nature. But if you feel that this subject matter, the subject matter being, you know, a very, very immoral time of our society in which, you know, one race decided to enslave another race, you know, that is horrible. And as Americans and as humans, we do, to a greater or lesser degree, have some responsibility to be aware of that. That's true. But again, I may have the responsibility as a human or and as a man to be aware of the fact that in LA, say, on any given night, however many rapes might occur, I would have that responsibility to take care of the women in my life or be aware of that or be more respectful towards women. I do have that responsibility. However, I don't have a responsibility to watch a film depicting the number of rapes in Los Angeles on any given Tuesday.
Okay.
I don't have that responsibility. I do have a you know, social responsibility to be aware of the issue, to be aware of that slavery took place. Mm-hmm. But I don't have, you know, I don't have a responsibility to watch a film in which, you know, slaves are brutally and immorally, unethically handled.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have an example of a movie where you felt pressured to see it, where you didn't necessarily want to or you wouldn't have otherwise seen it, but and tell us whether you caved in and saw it?
My example isn't exactly that, where I felt like social pressure, you know, from like a, you know, an ethical standpoint or like society standpoint, but just the most recent one I can think of, and I don't remember what the situation was, like a bunch of people were going to go see it or I wanted to see it or something like that, but it was Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Mm-hmm. And again, I haven't seen it, so I don't know, but I read several reviews that it maybe had one, if not multiple, rape scenes in it. And I chose to not see that because I don't want to, you know, watch women be brutalized in that fashion. You know, I just decided not to see it.
Yeah.
Because, again, just because – I feel like just because something occurs doesn't mean that I need to watch it.
Right.
And I didn't want to see that. I mean, all the time, every weekend, there are dozens of films out that it feel, quote unquote, like social pressure to see, but that I choose not to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Jeff, how about you?
It's like, off the top of my head, I can't think of a movie. I would say that there are films that I saw in film school that I don't think if I had gone to film school, I would have seen.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a lot of the French New Wave. They're films that I'm glad I have seen, not in my collection of films, not to name names, you know. Yeah. You know, I don't name names here. No, but just there's certain films that I admire and I respect. Not a film like, oh, I can't wait to go see The 400 Blows again. You know what I mean? I know. I want to name names.
See? Movie night. Get the popcorn out.
Exactly. But I do think you. That's a good point. Like you, we went to film school. Gabe, did you go to film school?
No.
Oh, okay.
See, now I'm feeling a little peer pressure here, right now. You know?
Well, okay.
Now I'm going to have to go to film school.
Precisely. Well, you better. We're going to give you a little film school education right here on this podcast. But so they do sort of encourage you to watch films that you might not otherwise have watched. And ultimately, are you glad that you saw these French New Wave films?
Yes.
Okay. So even if it wasn't maybe the most fun you've ever had at the movies.
I should say there are some French New Wave films I have enjoyed. I don't want to pick on the French New Wave. There's also some Bergman films and some, you know.
Absolutely.
Antonioni films that, you know, I don't know.
Antonioni. All right. Well, we're going to get to him.
I like Blow Up.
We're not naming names. We're not naming names.
See, this is what happens. Yeah. Yeah, but yes.
Okay. So on that note, Gabe, next week, 12 Years a Slave.
No comment.
Or we could just go see the new Coen Brothers. Okay, and for our final segment, we are all in the industry, and we're all trying to make our very, you know, our ridiculously unrealistic dreams
come true.
All right,
Pauline, can we take that again and just sound more enthusiastic, you know? We're up and comers, you know, I'm getting depressed sitting here just with that intro.
All right, let's take two. All right, guys, for our third segment, we're all budding filmmakers, you know, creative types. And we, as such, we're all, you know, excellent procrastinators. So Gabe and I were talking about using this podcast as a means of, you know, incentivizing, or at least a means of like pushing us into actually doing the creative projects we always talk about doing instead of, you know, just talking about them. So let's just really quickly go around the table and discuss, you know, what we've been working on. And basically the point of this segment is for the listeners to hold us accountable. And each week we better have made at least a little progress. So Jeff, why don't you start?
Okay. Well, this year I started to work on my first feature film, and I say my first feature film in sense of writing it, directing it, and producing it. I was also going to star in it, but I decided not to for various reasons, mostly the fact that I just don't know if I could have handled all those other things in addition to acting. So I filmed it over the summer. And I've been in the middle of editing it and hopefully having it ready by next year. So that's my thing.
We'll stay tuned.
Awesome.
All right, Gabe.
I just completed a short film, which I produced. It's called Subterranean Lovesick Blues. It's a send-up of the Bob Dylan song, Subterranean Homesick Blues. And you can search for it on YouTube. Subterranean Lovesick Blues.
And if I can figure out how to get our website working, then I'll link it in the show page.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Mine is pretty much this podcast. It's pretty much, I've not so much been focusing on making movies, but talking about movies. It's really interesting when you try a new creative endeavor and you just feel like you're lost at sea and you just so rely on the help of your friends and strangers to a certain extent, the good people at Guitar Center. And hopefully, if you are listening to this, that means we have a website and a means of either downloading this or listening to it on the internet. And that means that I have successfully embarked on this journey. So hopefully all goes well. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Join us next week for our discussion of Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story. Thank you, Jeff, for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
And Gabe, as always.
Thank you.
Take care, guys.